Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The presidential trend, the remarkable voting predictability of the office of president this hour of the program, and it includes, although we won't get to it right at the top of the show, we'll wait till the hour goes on, a 2016 election analysis. Tony Fairfax is a demographic consultant and engineer, and he provides demographic mapping and redistricting services. His clientele, many nonprofit and public sector groups. He was studying numbers, and he found that there was a trend that really very few people knew about, and yet it continues to have an impact on voting and on voters in the United States. It's a phenomenon that once existed in the U.S. voting electorate from 1972 to 2000, with the exception of 1976. The popular vote for the Democratic candidate clearly followed a straight line or linear trend, a linear presidential trend. In fact, he discovered that it was so straight and predictable that the popular vote for the Democratic candidates for the elections of 92, 96, and 2000 could have been determined in 1988, with an accuracy of 99% or better. Bill Clinton and Al Gore would have known their popular vote within an error of 1% or less almost 4 years prior to their first presidential run. So he looked at a number of issues. He had to, of course, find out essentially why this was. Why was Republican vote more fluctuating and Democratic vote linear? And it required looking a bit before 1972 as well to see what was going on with voting at that time. So Tony is with us this hour. And toward the end of the hour, we'll give predictions for 2016. Our phone number for you to join this conversation this hour is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Hi, Tony. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So when did you decide that you were going to look at the Democratic vote? Were you just looking around at numbers and then you decided to look at votes from year to year, presidential votes? Or how did this all come about?
It came about purely by accident.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. I was looking at the Census Bureau report, the statistical abstract for the U.S., and I came across this graph, and I kept coming back to that graph. And the graph was the presidential popular vote for the Democratic, Republican, and independents combined. And it was from 72 to 2000. And I kept coming back to that graph for some particular reason. Then I realized why I was coming back. There was this unique trend on the graph. And once I noticed it, I was intrigued because it shouldn't take place. A graph like this, a straight line, shouldn't occur. If you think about it, I mean, every presidential election has different candidates, usually different opponents against one another. That should fluctuate the popular vote. Different issues come up. Think about the issues from 72 to 2000. That should change. Different economic conditions, you know, from internally in the U.S. to global conditions. And some people, even today, some analysts believe you can predict who's going to be president using economic models. And last but not least, the voter turnout percentage changed from presidential election to presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just didn't make sense. So I delve into that because it just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. And on the other hand, the Republican graph would show much more fluctuation. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. When you look at the same period of time, 72 to 2000, you see a fluctuating Republican candidate's popular vote and a fluctuating independents combined. And so that's the way it should be. There should be some fluctuation. So the oddity was not the Republican fluctuating. It was this linear trend that exists. And so, you know, because I did some research and saw if anybody had written anything, any analysis, and I couldn't find anything, so I was compelled to come up with my own theory.
Mm-hmm. And you also had to look at pre-72, right, to come up with the year 72 for this linear motion.
Exactly. The conclusion I came to was that the trend started in 72, But I think what occurred actually occurred in the 60s and prior to that. And so although you get this linear trend in 1972, that was sort of the beginning of this linearity of the Democratic popular vote. But what occurred to our electorate actually occurred in 68, really, and prior to that time.
Well, let's jump right into 1968, which you call a realigning election. What happened?
Well, what happened was really the result, I guess, of the 60s. Some people call the 60s the turbulent 60s. And if you, you know, can recall, there was this recreational drug use, an increase of recreational drug use that people thought was going on. And when I say thought was going on, something occurred with television at that particular time where, for the first time, you had information that was placed inside your living room. So even though it wasn't occurring everywhere, you saw it on the news. And so people saw news reports of recreational drug use. They saw news of that sexual revolution that was going on in the 60s, people moving to different communes out west. Again, wasn't occurring with everybody, but people saw it for the first time in news reports. There was that women's liberation movement. I don't know if you remember. People saw women burning their bras out in the public sector to show their freedom. So people saw this. And so there was a group of people that actually felt that the country was moving in the wrong direction and made things just unsettling. At the same time, you had several assassination attempts.
Yes.
Major assassination attempts. John F. Kennedy, of course, we know. Bobby Kennedy. You had three civil rights leaders. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Medgar Evers. And these were people that people read about in the newspaper and saw on television. And never before there was a decade with this amount of notable assassination attempts. The war in Vietnam was also unsettling with people. People just felt it was going on. Something was going on wrong with the country. And a group of voters, a group of population in the country wanted to show, I guess, their disagreement with the direction of the country. And they did that in 68, the 1968 vote for the president. They did that with voting for a gentleman named George Wallace. And they disagreed with the direction of the country, and they voted for George Wallace. They didn't vote for the Republican, so they didn't purely vote against, or they just weren't Republicans at that particular time. They were what I call non-Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have in 1968 is a shifting away from voting for the Democratic candidate for president. And let me go back a little bit to George Wallace and why George Wallace was a key. Also in the 60s, you had three civil rights acts, a major civil rights act that occurred in a short period of time, a 1964 Civil Rights Act, 1965 Voting Rights Act, and 1968 Fair Housing Act. And I think the Fair Housing Act was that last straw that sort of broke the camel's back of these voters that voted away and shifted away from their Democratic candidate for president because they had to choose someone to show their anger with. And the interesting thing is that George Wallace was the same George Wallace that stood in the doorsteps of the University of Alabama, and people knew that, against Vivian Malone and James Hood to stop them. You know, he was the same George Wallace that spoke those famous or maybe infamous words of segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever. And he did that at his inaugural speech. And so, you know, many times the inaugural speech is an uplifting speech. And so you have to put it in the context of that. And so he had that brand in 68. And so this is the reason why I think civil rights was sort of this linchpin that these individuals followed him over because the brand at that time for George Wallace of this sort of states' rights, anti-civil rights person. So the voters that voted for him knew about that. And so they shifted away after those three seminal Civil Rights Act away from voting for the Democratic candidate for president. And they didn't come back, except for that one election year that you mentioned before, 1976.
Yeah, you remind us of LBJ's prescient comments. I think that we have just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come.
Absolutely, and I don't think he realized the impact on that particular aspect and on that particular vote. And it occurred almost immediately with the presidential election. It didn't occur with other levels, meaning the House and Senate and congressional. It did not occur with those right away. And that's why some people have a debate whether there wasn't a realignment or whether there wasn't. But right away, there was a realignment that showed up, and it showed up in 1972 to 2000.
And those who followed George Wallace in that campaign or who voted Republican in 68, where are they now, or where are their offspring? Are they still independents? Are they Republicans now?
Right. Very, very good point. The analogy that I put together is that the shifting of voters was akin to a fracturing of our electorate. And so our electorate at the presidential level is broken into Democrat electorate and non-Democrat electorate. Well, those voters that shifted over were not Republican voters, as I mentioned before. They're sort of independent voters. They're non-Democrats. They're inside this non-Democrat electorate. So they'll vote for the independent. They'll vote for the Republican, but they won't vote for the Democrat, and sometimes they don't vote. And so they morphed over a period of time. They, in my opinion, were the Wallace voters of 1968, the Perot voters of 1992, and they have now evolved into what I consider, I think, the Tea Party voters of today.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fracturing of the electorate initially left the progressive electorate with a much smaller number of potential voters than the conservative electorate. But 40 years later, we're seeing a bit of a change in that. The progressive electorate is gaining some strength. Yes?
Yes. What happened is that when this fracturing, and again, electorates don't fracture, but that's the analogy I think you have to look at in order to understand, you know, what went on. You can imagine that in 72, this Democrat electorate, where mostly Democratic voters were voting for the Democratic candidate. And that's how you got that linear trend, because it left the core base voters essentially voting for the Democratic candidate. That was much smaller than the non-Democratic electorate, everyone else. However, over the last 40 years, it grew faster to the point that the electorate of the Democrat electorate is about the same size and about a little bit larger than the non-Democratic electorate, that I give that electorate a little edge over the non-Democrat electorate. And so it grew faster, and it's continued to grow faster, and I can't see how it's actually going to stop.
Why? Why did it grow faster?
It grew faster mainly because if you look at young voters, first-time voters, they are turning more and more for the Democratic candidate. If you look at the, and actually if you look at racial groups, they're breaking more and more. If you look at even non-racial groups, they're trending more and more toward the Democratic candidate. But if you look at first-time voters, because that's the pump, that's the fuel that drives actually the new voters in, they went from in the 30% voting in 1972 for the Democratic candidate to now in the 60s. Mm. They're now in the mid-60s. So you get this influx of new voters every presidential election, voting increasingly more and more for the Democratic candidate for president.
Can you see, you say in the book, barring a major realignment shift in the overall electorate or a major shift in party policy, the Democratic popular vote in percentages have or are about to consistently surpass the non-Democratic votes cast. Do you see any kind of major realignment now with the Republican Party or with the Democratic Party? They both seem to be having some realignment going on here. They have candidates who we just haven't seen before. Is that happening in 2016, or is that a stretch to say there's a realignment happening now?
No, I think you're spot on. And I think it's, of course, more so for the what I call the non-Democratic and the GOP side.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for it is exactly what we talked about before. When these independent voters shifted over away from the Democratic candidate in this sort of non-Democratic electorate, many of them remained independent. Many of them would, again, as I said before, vote for the Republican, vote for the independent. They would not vote for the Democrat, and sometimes they didn't vote. So they weren't part of the core Republican base. But what you see over a period of time, what has occurred over a period of time, they have grown. Just like the Democrat electorate grew over those 40 years, those independents existing inside this non-Democrat electorate that voted sometimes for the Republican, they grew as well, and to the point that they are not as large as the core Republican base, but they're enough to actually influence who's going to get elected inside this sort of non-Democratic, and you might as well say GOP electorate.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of first-time voters, they're not going that direction. They're going the Democratic direction?
Exactly. Well, not them. Now, we're talking the overall electorate. If you look at the overall electorate, there are more people that are becoming Democrats for
yes.
first-time voters inside the GOP, let's say, but I call it the non-Democratic electorate. More of them are increasingly becoming this independent Republican.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're right with the point that there is a possibility of a fracturing of this. Because right now you can see it. There is a divide between the establishment, which I would say would be the core Republican, and these independent Republican
voters.
Sure
is.
Mm-hmm. And so as they get larger and larger, then a decision has to be made on which direction you want to go. And so you can see that now if the establishment picks this direction, these core independent Republican voters may decide to just break off.
Mm-hmm.
And form their own party. And in essence, they've kind of done that with the Tea Party. But the Tea Party was integrated into the GOP. Remember, when the Tea Party first came out, they were portrayed as being this new party, this independent party. But over a period of time, they have really been integrated into being just a part of the Republican Party. And so once they're in now inside, the Republican electorate, I call it again the non-Democratic electorate,
mm-hmm.
They have a much larger voice, although they're still smaller. They have a much larger voice than the establishment core Republican base. And it's just a matter of time before, they may decide that the core Republicans are not doing what they want, and they may break off.
Mm. And then we'll have to ask, and then what? Which we will in a moment. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Tony Fairfax is our guest this hour. His book is The Presidential Trend, The Remarkable Voting Predictability of the Office of President, which includes a 2016 election analysis. It looks at the popular vote for the Democratic candidate for president, which has increased in a linear and very predictable manner since 1972, with the exception of 1976. The votes for Republican and independent candidates were fluctuating. The trend is a basis for a new political theory, and it looks at the way that presidential elections are analyzed, and it says quite a bit about the future, who's going to win, who's more likely to win in 2016 and beyond based on this trend. Well, here's our phone number. Join our conversation. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or if you like us, which is nice, then you'll know, you'll get upcoming announcements. Not a lot of them, just what we're going to have on the air, so you'll be in the know. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. To you momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, lots of phone calls coming in. Let's start them with Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to share, I think I shared this once before, but I wanted to share a personal event with your speaker. In 1974, I was 17 years old. I was a Senate page for Senator
Wisconsin
Edward
Public
W.
Radio.
Brooke of Massachusetts, who was liberal, Republican, and African-American. And I roomed with Chuck Hardy from Oak City, Oklahoma, who was the speaker's page. And the speaker was from Oklahoma, was a conservative and a Democrat. This extremism in politics did not exist. We had people like Lowell Weicker from Connecticut in the Republican Party, and we had many conservatives in the Democratic Party.
Right.
And things got done when I was there for the impeachment of Richard Nixon, when both parties came together for the common good. And it seems now there are no more liberal Republicans. They're like the they're an extinct species. And I asked your speaker to what are the demographics that have contributed to this, what I would call extremism or extreme alignment in American politics. And I'll take my
thank you, Jim.
Here.
Thanks so much for your call, Tony.
Well, I think he hit a nerve there. I think one of the things that you see is a polarization that's occurred, and although the presidential trend showed a polarization immediately for the voters at the presidential level, it didn't necessarily or wasn't necessarily polarized at the lower levels. You saw actually, conservative senators actually in the North and not liberal but somewhat more liberal Republicans as well. But over a period of time, as I said before, there was a immediate fracturing of voters at the presidential level. Over a period of time, the lag of these lower level offices caught up to the point that now they're exhibiting the same fracturing, the same polarization that actually occurred 40, 50 years ago, to the point that they're actually becoming a mirror of this fracturing at the presidential election. And so in addition, over the last few years, you notice that the hyperbole has actually increased from party to party against each other. That also contributes to this fracturing. So I don't actually see the fracturing actually getting better. Actually, just to lay out some, you talked about demographics. Just to lay out some demographic numbers to you. In 1972, you had the white vote actually voting 31% for the Democratic candidate. You now had, in the last election, you had Barack Obama in 2008 getting 43% and then 39%. An increase in the performance of the Democratic candidate for president for the white population. In addition, of course, you have the minority vote actually shifting more and more toward the Democratic candidate. In the 70s, again after 70, you had the black population voting in the mid-80s. Recent elections, you have it in 90s, 95% in 2008, 93% in 2012. Hispanic population, the same thing. The 50s and 60s, now it's 70%. In the most recent percentage, 71% in 2012. Asian percentage, they're actually trending for the Democratic candidate as well. There wasn't a great enough sample size until 92. They were 30% in 92. Now they're 73% voting for the Democratic candidate in the most recent election, 2012. So you get this shifting of not just minority groups, but a trend of all population groups trending and shifting toward the Democratic candidate for president.
Mm. Thanks very much, Jim, for the call. Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
I would like to ask, this, my question is prompted by a discussion that I heard on NPR about the actual dynamics of the GOP convention and the fact that the delegates are, let's just say Trump in this case, the delegates are committed on first ballot and first ballot only. So if somebody is a delegate representing a district that voted for Trump, they go to the convention, they vote for Trump. Trump does not get enough to get the majority to actually get the nomination. So then they go to the next round, and at that point, all these delegates are freed up. In other words, they can go with whoever they really wanted, not just who won the district, or I guess whatever format their manipulation of the vote would take. But then this raises the question to me, the folks that you are talking about as non-Democrat voters in this block, are they also people who are doing that kind of getting into the Republican Party inner workings and becoming these delegates? Or are they just the people who show up at the polls like the rest of us and aren't really identified as part of their what they do in life?
Yeah, good question.
Very, very good question. I would imagine, are a sampling that permeates throughout. So that means that they're going to show up in the caucus. They're going to show up in the primary. And so you're going to see both these non-Democrats sort of permeate through. And you may show an intensified version, or you may show a not intensified version as well. Some people think that the Donald Trump voters will show up. Some people think they won't show up. There really isn't any way until that day to figure out. Some interesting facts, let's say, on the primaries and the caucus, just to throw in here. You can go back 40 years, and the GOP nominee comes from the top four positions of the Iowa caucus. By the time New Hampshire comes, you can go back 60 years, and the top two positions in New Hampshire picks the GOP nominee. By the time you get to South Carolina, from 1980 to today, there's only been one time that the top one position or the first place person didn't receive the GOP nomination. So that means if you have a strategy, that means your strategy is to get into the top four, get into the top two, and then you better place first place, or it may be a long, difficult road ahead.
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Well, I would just like to say that I know, you know, several of us, including you and me, Kathleen, who tend to identify as political junkies, one way or another, I think this is going to be about as entertaining a year as I can imagine happening. It might be scary, but it's sure going to not be dull.
Huh? No, it hasn't been dull, Scott. It's really not dull. Although some of it you just don't even want to have to pay attention to because it's not good. Thank you very much, Scott, for your call. I want to go back to what's causing some fracturing now. When I look at particularly Donald Trump, who nobody really saw coming, the issue that I hear loudly and clearly from him that people tend to be responding to, a lot of other stuff he says, I don't know how anybody responds to what he says, but this anti-immigrant seems to be at the core of what's causing the fracturing. Do you see it that way as well? And would it behoove, what would happen to the Republicans if they could come up with some kind of compromise on immigration and bring back to the fold all of these people who are Trump supporters?
Right. Unfortunately, that probably won't happen, given the situation between the president and the Congress. But let me just say this, that these independent Republicans who started as the Wallace voters and now I think morphed into these Tea Party voters, it makes sense because the same or similar issues, you can see them advocating for that back in the 60s. You can see the Tea Party voters advocating for that. So Donald Trump is speaking to that group of people. They're not going to, I think, be satisfied with a compromise. I think they tend to show that they want a certain outcome, and if they don't have that outcome, then they're not going to support that particular person or candidate. So it bodes well for Donald Trump if they don't come up with a compromise. I guess even if they do come up with a compromise, I think that there are many issues. I mean, you remember the comments on Muslims, not letting Muslims. This persona that Donald Trump has built, and I don't think it's by accident, I think it's by design and strategy, is appealing to that group off of strength, make America great again. When I first heard that, I thought, come on, you can't be, serious. But it makes sense. It's a simple phrase that just about anybody can understand. So getting back to what your caller said as far as maybe being a brokered convention, the Republicans are in a little quandary, and the reason for it is this. In order to have a brokered convention, you actually have to have many candidates that's going to divide the vote. And so the strategy then is eliminated of consolidating into one candidate and backing that one candidate against Trump. Because if they back that particular one candidate, but then Trump wins, then you're going to eliminate that second ballot that your caller talked about.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to win, and he's not going to have a second ballot. He's going to actually get the nomination. The only way is to actually break it up and actually divide that vote so much that he won't get that nomination. And so that's a quandary right there. How do you keep people in place? Do you keep funding candidates? Do you tell them to actually stay in place to divide that vote? Or do you risk the chance of actually galvanizing behind one candidate or two candidates, reducing it down where actually you can actually go against him? And that is a bit of a quandary.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Scott, for your call. We go to Tom in South Beloit. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I wanted to revisit some of your remarks earlier. You talked about the Tea Party, but weren't some of the early financial backers of the Tea Party organizers Republican operatives?
And yes.
They were working on the politics of divide, like the Republicans have done all along. I mean, you had the evangelicals voting for Jimmy Carter, but the Republicans managed to flip them for Ronald Reagan, and they've kept them since then. Their strategy of divide, those other people are getting your stuff, so vote for us, is what's made them effective, but it's finally starting to run out, it seems.
Absolutely. I think you're right on. There are evidence that shows that some of the backers of the original Tea Party were Republicans. Although the point I was trying to make is that when they were presented to the public, they were presented as this independent group of people, group of voters. They weren't part of the Republican. They weren't part of the Democrats, of course. They were just independent. But over a period of time, that they were morphed or integrated, as I said, into the Republican Party to the point that they don't even speak of the Tea Party as being a separate entity. It's almost a subset now, but that's not the way it was presented in the beginning. And your point on Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter is that outlier. That's the outlier that exists. So when you look at getting back to the original presidential trend that occurred, that linear line from 72 to 2000 for the Democratic popular vote, that 1976 with Jimmy Carter was an outline. They voted for Jimmy Carter. But in 1980, they actually came back, shifted again away from the Democratic candidate, and therefore continued to exist in what I call this non-Democrat electorate. And the trend line continued from 80 to 2000.
And thank you very much, Tom, for your call. Gary in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Just wonder if you and or your guest have noticed a disproportionate amount of negativity regarding Hillary on the mainstream press media versus seems like pity pat treatment for Bernie. Everybody's all gaga about Bernie, but my concern, if he were to get the nomination, he would end up being the George McGovern of 2016. And I think the elite would not like nothing better than to have Bernie Sanders run against their chosen horse on the other side. Wondered what you think about that theory. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Gary.
I think you're on to something. And part of the reason why I think you don't hear a lot of blasting on the media about their Bernie Sanders is because you hear a silent party, the Republican Party. They're silent on him. And, of course, that's by design. They would rather run against Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton. Although in the polls you see in some polls Bernie Sanders doing better than Hillary Clinton, but you can't rely on that at this particular time. And I think that your call is also on to something that, once Bernie Sanders got the nomination, I wouldn't put him in the class of McGovern, but I would say that he probably is an easier candidate to caricature than Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary Clinton, you've known about her for 20 years. I mean, she's been caricatured any way up and down, and so it's already baked in a cake. So her numbers are baked in a cake. We haven't seen that with Bernie Sanders, and so there is a gamble on that aspect of if Bernie Sanders wins the nomination. That being said, that's different than whether he could possibly win or not.
I'm wondering if when you've been looking at first-time voters, because I know you've done that, the first-time voters are part of the reason that Democratic line is a linear line. I'm wondering if there is anything to be looked at with the number of people who are under the age of 35, I think it is, or even 40, who are supporters of Bernie Sanders. It seems to me as though that's a large generation in this country. There are a lot of people in that age group. And Bernie Sanders is a different kind of candidate. I mean, somebody that calls himself a democratic socialist, who's calling for policies that, when healthcare was being debated, people said that's too liberal, it's never going to fly in this country. And here's a candidate who's mustering all this support for issues that in some ways come out of a New Deal. You know, they're really a change in government in many ways. The very enthusiastic response among the young people, what does that do to that linear Democratic line? And what does it do to the shape of that party? Does it make it forever more progressive?
The progressive or the trend lines are showing the electorate in the general. It doesn't speak to the primaries. That being said, I'm looking at a theory that I have that the progressive electorate, that Democratic electorate that exists, is becoming more progressive. And so this is the reason why a candidate like Bernie Sanders can actually come out of nowhere. And we saw this manifesting itself and beginning to manifest itself in 2004 with Howard Dean. Howard Dean, for some reason, people thought came out of nowhere. But then John Kerry actually took over. Barack Obama took advantage, if you will, lack of better words, of this progressive movement that's existing, super progressive, if you will, inside the progressive electorate or the Democratic electorate. And now I think there's even a larger progressive or super progressive group than it was 8 years ago. And that's the the question or the problem that Hillary Clinton has is not to take this for granted, because I think that this progressive group inside is growing faster, just like the progressive group overall of this of the electorate is growing faster than the non-Democrat electorate. There's a progressive group inside the progressive electorate that's growing faster than the overall progressive group or the non-progressive groups, non-super progressive groups, to the point that you have a different electorate, a primary electorate in 2016 that you did in 2008. So if I was advising the Clintons, I would say, you know, a year ago that you should expect someone like Bernie Sanders to come out. You know, don't not expect that to occur, and it actually did. Someone actually rode or is riding this wave of this new super progressive group that's coming out of the progressive electorate.
We welcome more of you to our conversation. Our guest this hour is Tony Fairfax, and his book is The Presidential Trend, The Remarkable Voting Predictability of the Office of President. It also includes a 2016 election analysis. And we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. He looks at the linear trend of Democratic presidential vote and says something substantial must have transpired prior to or during the 72 election cycle. He says, yes, actually, it happened in 1968. You had a fractured electorate. You had the civil rights votes that were cast by the Johnson administration, the policies that a lot of people made a lot of people leave the Democratic Party, particularly in the South. And part of that fracturing has resulted in core Democratic voters staying very consistent, new voters tending to be more Democratic. And we've reached a point now, back in those years, it made the Democratic vote, the progressive vote, much smaller than conservative vote, but over the years, the progressive vote has increased. So he says we've reached a point where the progressive and conservative voting electorates are almost equal in size and evenly matched. And so you have these contentious battles because you've got two powers about the same size, about the same speed, and about the same strength. And so they're at each other. So we're welcoming phone calls for him. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for the author of The Presidential Trend, The Remarkable Voting Predictability of the Office of President, Tony Fairfax. Our guest, John in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hello. I would like to ask your guest if he knows what happened to the progressive anti-war movement like old Bob La Follette and people like that who are willing to go to jail to oppose the government's war policies.
What happened to them? They're still in existence. I mean, they're still part of this sort of progressive electorate. So those individuals are still in existence, and still those voters that would do that are still in existence of the progressive electorate.
You make mention, thank you, John, of the Virginia elections 2013 and the astounding results from that and what they portend for other states and for a movement, increasing number of progressive victories.
Right. I think Virginia is one of the first states that are exhibiting this increasing progressive electorate at the state level. And so, again, we had in the governor's race a couple of years ago, you had statewide level races being won, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and attorney general, in an off-year election. In an off-year election, you have completely different demographics that actually favor the Republican more than the Democratic candidate, yet the Democratic candidates actually won. And I think it's because of this increasing progressive electorate finally reaching a threshold for Virginia. And I think that that's going to occur in other states. I think North Carolina is going to, it's going to occur in other states, of course, Ohio and Florida, where you will start to see that, that Democrats will take back the gubernatorial seats in each of those, maybe even Georgia over the next few years. And so it's a manifestation of this progressive electorate increasing to the threshold that they will actually be able to take over these statewide offices.
And you see that happening when, Tony?
Over the next few years. If you coincide the election, one of the keys is if you coincide the election with a presidential election, that's the perfect time for the Democrats to run.
Uh-huh.
If you're a Democrat, you should run in a presidential election year in November and run for either governor or run for the Senate, because you're able to now, to a certain extent, predict what that vote percentage is going to be within a certain tolerance. In off-year elections, it's not as clear-cut, because what you get is a more fluctuating turnout in off-year elections.
Yes.
Than you do in presidential elections, and it's about 20% lower many times in November.
So we've saved it until the end. What does all of your research, studying trends from 1972 and actually prior to 72, how does that inform for you the 2016 presidential race?
Right. I talked about the popular vote trend, and that's the linear trend from 72 to 2000. That no longer exists. It's not linear. But what does exist is a popular vote percentage trend. Now, it's not as linear as the popular vote percentage, but if you draw a trend line from 1972 to 2012, again, removing that outlier of 76, the Democratic popular vote percentage doesn't deviate more than 2.6%. So you can go anywhere on that trend line and actually predict what that popular vote percentage is going to be within 2.6% plus or minus. So you can actually extend that trend line. You can extend that trend line to 2016. And if you do extend that trend line to 2016, you see that the Democratic candidate should not get below 50% in this election this year, in November. That being said, some of you may be thinking, okay, that's the popular vote percentage.
Right.
What about the electoral vote? Well, the interesting thing about the presidential trend is that it exists at the national level, it exists at the state level, and it exists at the county level. Each level, it gets a little more, it fluctuates a little more and more as you move down from level to level, because people move from city to city, county to county, state to state. But at the national level, they stay inside the country for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's the most stable. If you look at, and I looked at the three major states, Florida, Ohio, and Virginia, you see once again that there's only one state that has a low end, and that's Ohio. That's lower than 50%. And so once again, you have a situation where the Democratic candidate should win Florida, Ohio, and Virginia. Of course, Ohio is that one that is unclear. And if they win Florida, Ohio, and Virginia, it's very, very difficult to see them losing the presidency.
Hmm. And on the other hand, the Republicans need to win at least two out of those three. Is that what you wrote?
No, actually.
They have to
actually,
win three.
They have to win all three and an additional one. And that's why it's an uphill battle for them.
Hmm.
You know, Barack Obama could have lost Florida, Ohio, and Virginia and still won the presidency in 2012.
Hmm. Interesting. So what's the next study for you, Tony?
Well, I'd like to look at look and delve a little more deeper into how the Tea Party relates to this presidential trend, the shifting of voters. I'd like to really look and dissect that a little more, because I do think that there's this relationship between the original shifting of voters away from the Democratic candidate and the manifestation of this Tea Party that came about in the 2000s.
And what do you do for a living? You do a lot of demographic work for nonprofits. What do you do?
Right. My specialty is in redistricting, and we could have a whole story.
Yes, we could, yeah.
And so I focus on redistricting. My hot and heavy period is in the decennial at the decennial period after the census occurs and I draw redistricting plans, I've reached a level of being able to testify as an expert in court. I've testified twice in federal court as an expert. And so that's the focal point. But I work on other demographically related projects as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for being with us, Tony. It was an interesting hour. Thanks.
Enjoyed it.
Tony Fairfax, the book is The Presidential Trend, The Remarkable Voting Predictability of the Office of President. It includes a 2016 election analysis. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, during the 1 o'clock hour, we're going to be taking a closer look at immigration and also at deportations. Immigration, of course, a real hot-button issue in the presidential race, and deportations. This president, President Obama, has deported millions of people. Are those numbers going down at all? And what exactly will the U.S. Supreme Court be looking at when they review the president's executive order on immigration? So that is coming up tomorrow during our 1 o'clock hour, and we hope that you will join the conversation. News is going to be on the air momentarily from National Public Radio.